200 episodes in just 13 months. It's been a sprint, and what a ride it's been. Along the way, I've spoken with incredible athletes, coaches, and leaders who've shared powerful lessons about resilience, leadership, and performing at your best. To celebrate episode 200, I'm sharing 7 standout moments from some of my favorite guests, conversations that capture what sporty's life is all about, growth, connection, and the drive to keep showing up. You'll hear the keys to team success from, firstly, Brett White, the former NRL star and head coach in waiting. We go inside the New South Wales camp and hear about building connection, vision, and purpose. We'll hear from the other Brett White, the leadership expert, and he will talk about leading with values and staying aligned under pressure. And then 4-time Olympian and world champion Dan Collins talk about how genuine connection drives peak performance. Then we'll change direction a little bit. We'll talk about some moments from disaster with Phil Moss, former A-League coach and leadership coach, the Maccabee Games tragedy and the power of natural leadership in a crisis. Talk to Andrew Swain, sports journalist and broadcaster and national curling representative. And he will talk about the experience of when he had lost his son for a fairly lengthy period of time. And any parent will know what that's like and how that helped him find a new perspective of life. And then lastly, we'll talk about overcoming setbacks. Firstly, with Matt Elliott, the former NRL coach and the founder of The Change Room, and him talk about facing health challenges and finding growth through adversity. And then Adam Mogg, former NRL player, State of Origin representative and real estate leader, talk about rebuilding after financial setbacks and redefining success. Whether you've been here from the start or you're just joining the journey, this episode is a celebration of the conversations, the insights, and the mindset that keeps us all chasing our next level. Let's get into it. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport, as I see it, is to see your vision become a reality, find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. I'm curious, as a New South Welshman, about last year, because what was clear from the outside is that there was a connection in that group that I hadn't seen for many years, and it got collective buy-in from the masses as well. Like, you never go to Queensland game 3 confident, but I just was. And that was just the effect of all of it. And I think it was just a general feel as well, is that people like actually believed. And it's not like the team was, you know, suddenly we had all these different players in there. We had a few new players, obviously, but there's obviously something magic about that camp, and you being a part of that must be a really proud moment.
Well, 100% right. It's funny. I actually said throughout the series that last year was the most connected I felt to the New South Wales jumper.
Yeah.
And I think however many games, half a dozen games, over 3 years or 3 series or whatever it was, that, yeah, playing in that jumper, and yet I felt most connected to it last year as an assistant coach. And that come from the group buy-in, but ultimately what we've been talking about is the vision that was set. Madge done a wonderful job of setting this, you know, where we're going and who we want to be. And the players saw that clearly, jumped on board. Wonderful group. Again, you talk about people, not only the playing group, but it was right through all the staff. It's probably one of the best groups I've worked with in terms of, you know, everyone just done their role. Helped out where they could, but again, we talk about that recipe of, you know, good people, the vision set, everyone goes about, works hard and gets their job done. Ultimately that's what, you know, and we did talk about, you know, that if we're all connected to the jumper, and do what's best for the jumper, it will be seen by, you know, the people in New South Wales, and they will ultimately connect to the jumper even further and be proud of it. And that's certainly the vision we wanted and chased. And you know, it certainly pleases me, you know, hearing you talk about that you know, you feel that it, you could see that from the outside. That was the feeling. And yeah, that was a real big goal of ours last year.
Yeah, awesome. The only letdown for me is I took my young fella to his first Origin game, and we knew after 8 minutes that the game was done, right? I was, again, really super impressive how the team hung in there, and there was still they were still in the game with 20 minutes, 15 to go. Like, that, again, super impressive. But then in the end, it's just in the modern day, particularly Origin, playing with a man less is nearly impossible. But I'm a bit of a footy nuffy, so I just absorb myself in all this sort of stuff. And I listened to Madge talk on multiple podcasts, on TV shows, and he talked about the length he went to. I heard ex-players talk about how, you know, Madge organised a coffee with me and he bought the jersey out. It was literally a physical connection as well as the emotional connection, bringing back that moment with Turvey, which Blues fans all remember. And it felt like we did a Queensland on Queensland. Like, that's what it felt like, even to the extent of, I remember the press conference in Melbourne where like, you know, you can say he wasn't rattled, but I reckon for the first time in his career, Billy looked rattled, and I was blown away. And it was super impressive what Madge did. And like you said, that requires collective buy-in. So yeah, well done.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
No, it was, like I said, it was just, yeah, all the sacrifice and hard work that goes into, you know, for all the players, all the staff, to have that, you know, pay off, and be a part of that. And something that's so big that, you know, to make, you know, New South Wales, the people in New South Wales, you know, proud and connected to that jumper again. I think it was just, it was great for our, you know, 1 hour game, for Origin. But more importantly, the sky blue jumper.
Yeah, and I think about, you know, teams talk about next up mentality, and the best teams have that, and it doesn't matter, they come in and they fall into the system. Like, I know they were out without some big names, but we're without some huge names, and yet those guys just stepped in and did the job. Yeah, again, super impressive. Interesting that you said the vision so important. And if I bring it back to, you know, a lot of what I talk about in this podcast is what you can apply to your life. That all of these things that we're talking about here today are so important. Like, you talked about having that vision and having that buy-in. You've got to have a vision for your life, right? Like, you've got to have those things in place. And if you put your leadership hat on, because you do work with businesses in your own leadership business, it's the same language, right? It's the same things need to be in place.
100%. It's a why. Why, you know, the vision is a why. Why are we here? Why do we get out of bed and go to work every day? Why, as a business, as a footy team, it crosses over so similar. Yeah, if people can see that vision, they feel like they belong, they're connected.
You mentioned values. Just did a I mean, it's often the first step for me when I'm working. Not often, it is the first step for me when I'm working with the team, yeah, is to get the values and purpose in place. I was working with a group of coaches who are going to be coaching teams with that same mindset, and it was, okay, well, how do we get this in place so that you guys know your values when you go out there and you deliver what you guys are wanting from the full football program? How important is that in a corporate environment? And I imagine, from what I've experienced in corporate, there's massive gaps in actually, one, there being values in place, and two, if they are in place, them actually being lived.
Yeah, I mean, I was working with a client yesterday, and not in the not-for-profit space, but a very big not-for-profit space, and the whole conversation started with me by putting the values that I just got off the website, you know, the pretty values that are there, and here they are, you know, courage and empathy, and, you know, okay, let's talk about how these are lived out in the context of your team. And yeah, you're right, like, unfortunately, a lot of companies have great mission statements and great values, and they look good on a wall and on a website, and that's pretty much the impact that they have. And so a lot of the work, again, I, like you, I often start at that place. Okay, so you're saying as an organization that you value integrity. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, when you look at values across the corporate world, there's a lot of words that get used a lot by everybody, you know, integrity, accountability, creativity, courage, you know, collaboration. Yeah. So having that conversation going, well, you say that these are your values, tell me how. And so for me, it's actually then unpacking that and going, what are, and this is one of the questions I would ask, it would be, what are the daily behaviors that you can live out every day that would demonstrate integrity, or that would demonstrate curiosity or collaboration or whatever the value is, and actually helping leaders and teams get some practical behaviors and practices that they can step into and do every day. Because, you know, I'm really big on the idea of, it's not what we do occasionally that creates change, it's what we do deliberately and consistently. And so what are the consistent daily behaviors that you can learn, adapt and grow in that are actually going to see that value lived out? So it moves from a nice word on a screen to, as you said, a lived out practice or value that means more than a website.
But absolutely,
it's a massive shift, and you've obviously experienced the same thing. As you know, I see these values on a wall, and I go, how is that lived and breathed in the organization? Now, there are some exceptions that do it well, but generally, it's pretty much not some nice words that mean nothing.
Yeah, spot on. And if you're thinking, the listeners, or the viewers, the family or their family organization, the other massive benefit when you've got those values in place and you know how to live them out because you've created statements around them, is it then takes out so much of the emotion around the conversations. Mm. It's like, we all agreed to these values and these behave demonstrations of actually living those values. Yeah. That's not what's happening here. And that way you're not having to have those emotional reactions, right?
So it increases accountability, but it also gets rid of what I would call kind of vague or invalid expectations. And so whether that's in a sporting team or a leadership team, we all have expectations of each other, of our boss, of, you know, everything. But most of the time, those expectations are invalid, and therefore they just create frustration and disappointment, right? So they have all these unmet expectations because no one really talks about it. So one of the big things that I often do, particularly connected to behaviors and values, is going, well, we need to, you know, I always say, like, there's three things that need to happen for an expectation to be valid. It's got to be communicated, it's got to be clarified, and it's got to be agreed upon. And so when you go through that simple process and you get that agreement, it's just like you said before, all of a sudden, we now have a standard, we now have a line, and that we can all be accountable to that because we agreed on it in the first place. So, you know, I think often there's these expectations, they might be communicated, they might be in a document, but they haven't really been clarified and agreed upon. And so therefore it just creates turmoil and chaos and confusion instead of alignment, which is what we're looking for in a football team or in a office. If we get alignment is when we get momentum to really do what we want to do and make it work.
Oh, love that. And that's not the first time a guest has mentioned that, the A word, alignment. Important. and what I love there is it made me think about you know, whenever I'm doing this with families or teams, is you make a bit of a joke about it and you say, for you kids or for you team members, you've got to make sure you call out the parents, or you've got to make sure you have to call out the coaches if they're not doing this too. And you get the coaches or the parents' permission to say, yeah, you need to, because I think it's so important to empower the whole team. like you were just describing before, like it gives people buy-in and they feel involved in the decisions, and that, yeah, it's a complete game changer.
You're
talking then about values, and what struck me is everyone has had an experience with someone through their life that touched their life some way. You described it when you're talking about football coaches and those post-it notes, but it's the same for leaders in whatever it is, whether it's a teacher in other areas of their life. The answers are all values pieces, aren't they? It's all about getting the values and the behavior right.
I mean, I steal that exercise that John O'Sullivan did, and I do it in a corporate leadership space, exactly the same question. What's a leader that has influenced you the most in a most amazing way or the most negative way? And same thing on a post-it, and it's the same result. You know, it'll be 85 to 90% is values, relationship, personal support, belief, and it'll be 5 or 10%, you know, skill, knowledge, and expertise. And it's the same in a corporate leadership space, in a not-for-profit, and a sporting environment, exactly the same.
Dan, I'd love to get your thoughts on something we talked about at the very start around connection. Like, how do you, like, you're an executive coach. I'm sure you're still doing some coaching, whether that's directly or indirectly in the sporting space. What's sort of a good lesson for people around creating more connection in their environments?
I think there's a couple of levels. So I look at it first, in your environment, is there's a connection around what we can do for each other. So at the task, the hands. So can I be useful for you? Yeah. Right. So and how do we be useful for each other? So that's a great conversation. Right. I think that's a great, that's one, that's the starting of, well, how do we be useful for each other? That's a great connection, right?
Yep.
And for you to really clearly explain to me, hey Dan, this is what I need from you. You know, like, I need this from you, and us to have that exchange, what a great connection, right?
Absolutely.
And when I hear that from someone, if I can do it, I make a commitment and make a promise. That builds connection. That's at the task. Then I think when we do that regularly enough, we build trust. So there's another form of connection, right? So then there's a connection via, you know, building trust. But I think there's also a connection around, and this is where I think society's really got it wrong, is having conversations where we disagree.
Yes.
Like the best way to build connection is to forcefully put forward your view and not have to be right.
Yeah.
Put it forward. You to do the same and us to have a conversation about it. And then, because understanding and connection happens on the other side of the disagreement, not on this side of it. You know what I mean? Like, it's we have to, and unless we disagree and have an adult conversation around that disagreement or that misunderstanding, or then there's no connection.
Yep.
So I think firstly, make commitments to each other is a great way for connection, and understand what you can give to your mates. But also too, be courageous enough and to put forward your view. And you don't have to be right. Like, I change my views all the time. Oh, because I'll put forward a view and someone will say, that sucks, Dan. and this is why it sucks, Dan. And then I go, yeah, you're right. And then I change my mind.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then I've improved, and we've built a connection because we understand each other. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those two things are missing from, you know, making commitments,
yeah,
and holding each other to account, and having really conversations where we disagree, but then we understand, you know.
It's such a great point, and we look at what the world's been through in the last 5 years, there's been a lot of people trying to yell their opinions, maintaining that they're right. And everyone's got a different version of right, no matter where you sit on all sorts of spectrums. And I remember listening to a video a few years ago, and the guy said, people would rather die than be right, than be wrong. I was like, what was it, Nate? They'd rather be right and die than ever admit they were wrong. So from whatever treatment they're getting or whatever it is, like they'd rather just be stubbornly sticking to it. And it's like, what if you could just look at things objectively and go, well, we can disagree. And you see it every day on social media. Like even on some of my posts are getting people going there and people go, how do you deal with people doing that? I'm like, well, they're just having their opinion. Like, and I'll say, thanks for sharing, but I'm not going to agree with it. I'm not going to argue it because there's no point.
But that's the wonderful point, isn't it? Like, you don't have to buy it.
No.
You know? But to have views is important. I think we've got some really important principles that you never want. You want them to be unyielding, you know? Like, I love the fact that our society is, we're democratic. You know, we vote, you know, we get rewarded for effort. You know, we're relatively progressive. We can have difficult conversations in our society and agree to disagree. You know, they're things that we should never let go of, that we should protect fiercely. But then there's things you just go, well, you don't need to die in a ditch about that. Like, but it's important. But it's important to have the conversation so we understand. I think to build connections, be okay with not being right, and be okay with listening to people, and I think a lot of the time, asking a question around someone's view and then challenging that view, that's how we get understanding, you know. But just as important, I think that first one you talked about, connection, make promises to people and follow through. You know, and ask people to make promises to you and hold them to account, and all of a sudden you've got connection, right?
Yeah. You know? I can remember being a fairly mediocre worker in my job and then going through this transformation about 15 years ago. And then I remember one of the executives saying to me, you know what, you do something that's very rare. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, you say you're going to do something, you do it. And it's like, oh, really? I guess I had a lot of big promises prior to that and just never delivered on anything. And it's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing the progress you can make and the impression you can create on people by being true to the commitments you've made. So I love that.
Make them. You've got to make them.
Yeah, you've got to make them. That's it.
You've got to ask for commitments from others. Otherwise, there's no connections. Very one way, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You mentioned the Maccabee Games. I think you were telling me, like, was it you or your brother was like right at the edge where the bridge broke? Like, that must have, well, I don't know, did it, like, must have been a traumatic aftermath in a lot of ways for the both of you.
Yeah, it was. And I was in journalism at the time, so I sort of did a couple of first person pieces from over there for the Daily Telegraph and the Manly Daily, and I guess that was good for me because it was kind of a counseling.
Therapeutic. Yeah,
right. Therapeutic, yeah. That's right, yeah, for me to actually write what I was experiencing. But, yeah, my brother, the bridge was built like that. It went over the Yarkon River and it was an arced bridge, a temporary bridge, and it collapsed in on itself. So it was almost like a trap door. And the Australian cricket team, of which my brother John was a member, was right at the top of the arch when it collapsed. So they were almost the first to hit the water. And I just remember the first screams that came out were gunfire, because there was some unrest in Israel at the time, that obviously there still is, but there was a yell of gunfire. So we were on a path leading towards the bridge. I was probably about 150 meters from the bridge, because it was all in alphabetical order of the sports, cricket before soccer, and then someone said, no, the bridge has collapsed. And I'm thinking, I know my brother would have been there or thereabouts, so I've started running towards the bridge. There were some army officers with machine guns.
Even though there's talk of guns, you're just completely.
Well, there was, yeah, that was in my mind, but then I heard the bridge has collapsed. Right. So that was probably what gave me the courage to actually run rather than into gunfire. But there were army guards there with machine guns across their chests, and yeah. I actually grabbed one because he stood in my way as I was running full pelt, and I used to have a bit of speed back in those days. And I literally, he said, "You can't go in there." And I said, "My brother's in there." He said, "No, you're not going." And I grabbed him by the gun and actually threw him out the way. Now I'm 5'10", and back then was probably about 90 kilos dripping wet. He was about 6'2", 6'3", and, you know, built and trained. But that's your survival instinct, right?
Adrenaline.
I knew my brother was in trouble, and adrenaline, and anyway, I found him scampering up the side of the riverbank, actually holding a couple of other people, dragging them to safety as well. So, you know, you talk about heroic moments under duress. That was certainly one of them. And, you know, luckily for my brother, he only copped a badly corked leg out of it because he landed on some of the scaffolding, but there were others a lot worse off, and it was tragic for the Maccabee Games. We had 85,000 people in the stadium waiting to cheer us on for the opening ceremony, and we never made it because of this bridge, and we lost four lives. So it was absolute tragedy, but out of it came a galvanizing experience at those games, and the cricket team, I think, won. I'm pretty sure they won it, gold medal, and the football team under the late great Ian Gray had our best ever finish. There was some silver linings in a pretty dark cloud.
Into our bosses at the time, I was like, give me one game. I just want one game. I don't care what it is. Just give me one game. And Clarkie was the same. He was like, all right, mate, you can call Argentina v. New Zealand. I was like, beauty. Argentina v New Zealand, Tri Nations game or rugby championship game.
Yeah.
I get to call a rugby championship game. So my first ever test match. And I was a little bit nervous on the day. Our family, incidentally, at that time, were having a bit of a staycation up in the Northern Beaches. My mother-in-law was down visiting. We had an apartment on the Northern Beaches. And so I'd taken we'd all family had gone up there, stay in this apartment. And the morning of the test match, I'd taken the kids to Narrabeen Lake there, where there's the playground there.
Yeah.
And had a play. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to see you later. I said bye to my wife and the kids. Went back to the apartment to get ready to go out to Parramatta where the game was. And I get a phone call from my wife. She's like, I've lost Will. So my son was probably four and a half at the time.
Yeah.
Like, I've lost Will. I was like, what do you mean you've lost Will? She's like, yeah, I've lost Will. I can't find him anywhere. He scooted off. And we're like, oh, no. And she's like, I'm panicking here. We've lost him. So we ended up losing. My son went missing for 40 minutes.
Oh,
long time, right? A lot of people at Narrabeen.
You think of the really scary,
like the lakes right there. Like he was pretty good at, he would have been able to save himself swimming at that point, but he was only four and a half. You know, anything could happen. So I'm running up and down in my suit that I'm about to wear out to Parramatta, running up and down Narrabeen Lake looking for him, calling out for him. We had police looking for him. We had, completely, it was like panic stations.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was walking around the lake. I could have kept going, but I was like, I'm just going to take a left here and see what's up here. Found him standing on a corner with a young couple who had found him at pretty much the same time. And then the police, we all arrived at like the same time and found him all at once. And I was like, in the meantime, I was ringing ahead these guys saying, I rang Clarkie. I was like, mate, you might need to step up and call this game. I've lost my son. Can't find him. Ringing the producers.
Yeah.
It was just hectic. Mayhem. Found him. Eventually got him back to the family. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go. I'm good to come. So I drive out to Parramatta. And that morning, I was a little bit nervous about my first test match.
Yeah.
But I'm driving out to Parramatta. I'm like, mate, it's just a game of footy.
Yeah.
How lucky are you? You get to go call a game of footy.
Got chills on that one. That's a
hundred. Yeah. Right? Well, and so I get to Parramatta call that game, and it turns out that is the first time. So that was the game where Argentina beat the All Blacks for the first time in their history. It was history-making game. It was one of those classics that'll live forever.
I'm having memories of you posting. Did you post a snippet at the end of the game or something on your?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think I might have. And I got a photo with, I had George Gregan on one side, Andrew Mertens on the other, who was filthy because the All Blacks had just been beaten, and Rod Kafer, and I got a photo with those guys, and it was one of those moments that I'll never forget. It was an unforgettable game. The Argentinians afterwards were going absolutely crazy. They'd beaten the All Blacks for the first time in their history. It was some massive moments in that game. I remember driving back to Narrabeen afterwards and sitting in the bar downstairs of where we were staying and just going, exhale with two schooners. I was like, oh, I think you deserve a beer. That was a crazy, crazy day in my career. But it taught me the importance of, at the end of the day, we're not landing planes. We're not saving, we're not doing brain surgery or anything like that. It was, so I really enjoyed that day because of what I'd experienced previously. And it just so happened to be one of those history making games. So that was really cool. And I still remember that so vividly, that
the panic,
that feeling when I get that feeling of just helplessness, and then that feeling when I get home later that night thinking, what just happened? It was a really crazy sort of a day.
Well, the health setback actually came in 2012 when I was still coaching, and I was in between head coaching at Penrith and the Warriors. I spent a year at the Roosters, and I came across Anthony Minicello. So I got a background in sports science and thought I knew a lot about nutrition, particularly sports nutrition. And I'd got an autoimmune disease, which I retrospectively learned that was from lifestyle stuff. Then the doctor was right. The doctor said, you've had this your whole life. Something set it off. The drugs I give you will help you mow the lawn, basically, for the rest of your life. And Anthony, I didn't tell anyone because being a, you can tell by my orbit, we don't really say too much about that sort of stuff. So I thought I was suffering in silence, but Anthony Minicello recognised there was something not right with me, and he introduced me to a way of eating which was developed by a dentist in the early 1900s.
Yeah, right.
A guy called Weston A. Price, and his foundation still goes, which is kind of the origin of where all keto and paleo diets come from, to be honest with you. Really interesting story. A dentist traveled around the world at that time. I mean around the world, he went everywhere. And he was really fascinated by the impacts of diet on dental hygiene. And if you think about it, if our dental hygiene's not great, it's probably an indication that our health's not great. You only probably have to see a homeless person, right, to sort of have a little bit of an insight into that. But fascinatingly, I was all into carb loading because I was in high performance, it was very interesting that within 6 weeks of following that way of eating, I was off all medication, and I've been injecting myself twice a day with a steroid, living on painkillers and sleeping tablets as well.
Wow.
Wasn't pleasant. Yeah, so I thought I'd cured myself. I found out last year after 12 years that no, it is still there. The doctor was right. I can bring it back if I want to change my lifestyle. So that's kind of where the interest began. I obviously was still very engaged in rugby league then, but my health issues, which I kept quiet, ultimately sort of made me not as as connected to all my players as I should have been at that time. So I take full responsibility with that. I probably should have addressed it, you know, a little earlier.
Yep.
But again, finally, after coming out of coaching, I was very, you know, I understood that a high performance approach is actually not, that's not a real word. It's a human performance approach. Because if it works for Anthony Minicello or it works for a gold medalist, it'll work for you too.
Yeah.
And so I started a program that, you know, when we now have 5 international best-selling authors, 3 TED talkers, 2 doctors that specialize in human dynamics. Anthony Minicello obviously was the first person I went to, who's now a nutrition coach, and it's starting to come out. I saw Cameron Munster come out and actually acknowledge him as well. And unfortunately, Minnie's way too humble. The amount of, we've had over 3,000 people come through our program.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a lady, she broke the record. End of last year, she lost 100 kilos following Minnie's.
Wow.
Yep. And she'll lose more because she's getting loose skin cut off. But equally, in the same way of eating, the same way that cured me, we've had emaciated people come through our program, you know, because of overuse of medications and illicit drugs, and put weight on, eating exactly the same way.
Yeah, wow.
Again, Australia's leading breathing coach, who I met through Mick Fanning, a guy called Narm Baldwin as well, you know, coached Jess Fox and her sister, Jess at 2 Olympics. So, and, you know, obviously Mick won a couple of world championships and, you know, a couple of other world, and he's been at the Roosters and the Blues and Richmond as well when they won titles. So we've got pretty high level people. The reason I share that with you is that this is not all my knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, I've been so fortunate over the last decade to be able to tap into, you know, what is cutting edge or was cutting edge, now leading edge stuff, but it's all scientifically validated as well.
Let's start talking business. So were you in through all of these years already sort of building this business plan in your head, or you were taking action on it, or like where was all that at as you were playing still?
I'm going to be pretty honest here, and it's pretty hard to say, but I'm not going to mention any names, but I left France in my mind. I was in the middle of building a property portfolio. I had about 18 months to go. Back then, we're talking 2010, you know, so I was probably in the top 10% of players paid in the game. I wasn't wasting my money, but I had land, I had spec homes built, I had duplex land, and I had a plan to sort of build all that out. And the club wasn't going well, and I took it upon myself to leave the club under my own accord, and left an awful lot of money in France, and that pretty well set me and my wife upside down and broke. You know, I've never said this publicly before, but we started from scratch basically at the end of 2010. We left somewhere in the vicinity of $600,000 or $700,000 cash in France. And I felt like, being the most senior player at that club, it needed a staffing change. And we'd had 2 kids in France. My wife wasn't necessarily happy. And I said to her, look, let's go home. This is going to put us at bottom of the barrel and we're going to start again. And we pretty well finished our footy career with nothing. And happiness is one thing and money's another. And, you know, that club was in its second or third year of inception. And I know that the money they saved on me would have went towards making the staffing changes they need long term. So, yeah, so mate, it's you think you finished footy career and you got all this money and you've paid off your house or you got a couple of houses, whatever. Our wife and I pretty well started from zero and built ourselves up again.
Wow, that's a massive call. So when you say you left money over there, like because you had property over there, or because of what you would have been paid if you'd stayed?
I would have been paid if I stayed. Saw out the next 18 to 20 months of my career. It was a tough one for us.
Having gone through something similar about what's probably 8 years ago now, it's sometimes, like you said, happiness and family is more important, those things. Doesn't mean you can't rebuild, but you're never making a wrong decision if you're making the right decision for your family and for your happiness and for their happiness, right?
Yeah, and, you know, in my mind, I had a lot of French players talking to me about certain things within the club and I went there to play my best footy and to contribute to a new club. It was a challenge for me. I just played State of Origin, so I was at the peak of my career. Probably could have gone on a kangaroo tour at the end of 2006 had I not signed to go to France. Yeah. Maybe not have got a run, but I would have been close. We just won the Origin series and, you know, I was in form. I think I finished up in the top two or three centres that year in the NRL. So I would have been on a hiding to nothing to go on a kangaroo tour, I would have thought. But, you know, so I went there for all intents and purposes to play good football for the French guys and the French club. And in my mind, I felt like it was the best move, you know, for my wife and kids. Definitely wasn't the best move for us financially, but I think it was also the best move financially for that club, to free up that money. And we were still getting checks off sponsors, you know, at that point, you know, as part of our pay. So, it's a long way off, you know, fortunately, the club's went on from strength to strength and done some special things since our time.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's part of your legacy there, I guess, the fact that you've not just what you provided for yourself, but for the club. That's a massive call, mate. Massive credit to you.
Most people wouldn't know, mate. Most people I played with wouldn't know. Most of the French guys wouldn't know why I left. We left quickly. So I never really got to say goodbye to them. Once I sort of told everyone formally at a season lunch, the coaching staff at the time wouldn't allow me back at training. So it was definitely some conflict between me and the coach at the time. But I felt like I made the right move for the longevity of that club and the future French players that were always going to play in that.
200 episodes down, and I just want to say a massive thank you to every guest who's shared their story and to you for listening, learning, and being part of this growing Sporty's Life community. If this episode hit home, share it with someone who'll get value from it. And if you're ready or even just a little curious about taking your own performance to the next level, reach out and get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sporty's Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.